Hi, and welcome to episode 60. If you haven't already, I recommend that you go and listen to episode 59.5. This explains why this episode has been released so late. Again, apologise for this episode being released late. I hope you enjoy it, and here it is. Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin, working on the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer techie wants to know more about this, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
I'm not Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
So yeah, I'm back again, covering for Andy on this occasion. And this is episode 60. So 60 is the smallest number, which is divisible by the numbers 1 to 6. And I've been led to believe that the ancient Babylonians also used to use base 60, which is the reason why there's 60 minutes in an hour, 60 seconds in a minute, etc., etc. The European route E60 runs from Brest, France, to Constanța, Romania. Something about Buckminster Fullerene. Do you want to go about that one, Jeremy?
It has 60 carbon atoms. Yeah, I'll put that in the show notes with no explanation.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for that. In darts, a treble 20, which is the highest score that can be achieved with a single dart. It's the code for the international direct dial calls to Malaysia. It's diamond wedding anniversary in years after you got married. It's the number of miles per hour an automobile, a car accelerates to from rest. So it's 0 to 60 is one of the standard measurements performance. It's a common speed limit in miles per hour for freeways in most US states. And weirdly, also in kilometers per hour in urban areas in Russia. And of course, most importantly, it is the Admin Admin Podcast for this week.
Yay. So yeah. How is everybody?
Pretty good, thank you. Pretty good. Yeah. It's nice to be back again.
Yeah.
Mustn't grumble.
Well, I'm stuck in a hotel room in Southampton, so I'm happy, not, but there you go. Turn the dough, you know, you have to do these things. So, So what have you been up to? I've been kind of, I've just been working really, but I've been doing a lot of learning Python with the book I was talking about the other week, Payne's Manual. It's really good. I've written a tic-tac program which you can play against yourself or against the computer. So yeah, and it's really good. I don't know if it's probably the most efficient code, but it seems to work. And I've done some regex to make sure that value rented. So yeah, it's interesting. Learning, I think you definitely want to learn a bit of code. You need to have a project to do, I think.
So is this code on GitHub or anything?
Not yet, but I'm hoping to. Might be after today, after our discussions today. And I was also, if you remember, our Telegram group, that I was having a problem with indentation, working out which is the best way to get it. I think if you press control and I think it's brackets or square brackets, it will automatically push the text to the right, in Atom anyway, to the right way, so that you've got the right indentation. Because I think Python 3 can be quite fussy about indentation, isn't it? Because that's how it works with
it's... Yeah, I think all versions of Python are fussy about white space. It's used to denote things like loops and things, isn't it, as I remember?
Yes, if and statements.
Yeah, all kind of program flow statements use indentation as notation. Which does tend to lead to most people that are not used to doing Python sort of pulling their hair out. Why aren't there brackets here? Why aren't there curly braces? It doesn't make any sense.
But no, I'll put up on the code up on GitHub or whatever, so that you can have a look at it and make some recommendations. I mean, it all works quite well if you play against someone else, but it's a bit random because I haven't worked out yet. Because it just basically, it just, once the first player goes, the second player, the computer goes, it just randomly picks a spot which isn't being used. So obviously it's quite easy to beat because it just randomly puts it. So I need to work out how you kind of, I guess you have to teach it, or I don't know, or work out an algorithm to choose.
Have you seen the film War Games?
Mm-hmm.
That's got the computer in that's how they teach it, that war is pointless or something, I think. They get it to play tic-tac-toe against itself.
The only way to win is not to play.
So
I need to work out how you would do that kind of thing. I'm guessing you teach it if it sees something with more than two to block it kind of thing, but I need to work out. But for my first attempt, I was quite happy to think about 100 lines of code without it. Yeah. So what else has everyone else been up to, Jerry?
I've been doing various bits and bobs. Mostly I've been concentrating on, again, test-driven infrastructure stuff, which I've been doing at my day job. One of the things I've been asked to do is to do a wrapper script for a thing called Test Kitchen. I'm not sure if I talked about this last episode, but it's a way of testing your automation code. So Ansible is actually built for Chef, which I've barely used, but you can apply it to your Ansible code. And what happens is you need a configuration file in your role or your group of roles that needs testing, and it specifies things like what are you going to use to test it. Are you going to use a Vagrant box, so you know, a virtual machine, or are you going to use Docker and that kind of thing? Where to find the playbook to run to test your code, and that sort of thing. But there's a lot of boilerplate which goes into each and every role that you need to test. So the purpose of this wrapper script was to put that boilerplate in place with the minimum of fuss. That code might appear, depending on how my employer feels about it appearing. It's written in... Sorry.
I was going to say, the argument for anything like that is if you've taken publicly accessible code and tweaked it, there's an argument to be made for, if it's just open source code that you're tailoring to your environment, there's no benefit to the company to indicate why it's to make that company secret. You know, whereas if it's commercially sensitive, so say for example, if you are building something with that then goes on to run your production environment, then that's when they might turn around and say, actually, no, we don't want that. Yeah. Anyway, that's the argument I took, and I won that one at work. So
No, I mean, I do just want to check before I make absolutely. It available. That's the main. I can't see any problem with it. In fact, my sort of line manager has indicated that it would be a good idea. To be honest, it's just a load of bash code, which is could probably be done better. So, but it took me a long time, and I'm quite proud of it. So, it's the bash code sort of hands off to Ansible, and then gives variables to Ansible to build the template, and that Ansible basically does the templating for this configuration file, and then it hands off a bit of stuff back to the script after it's done that, so that's what it does. It took me a long time. It's kind of one of the my first bits of development, really. I wish that I could have done it in something other than Bash, but I don't think I'm good enough in anything other than Bash to get anything done at this point. So, especially not on the company dime, as it were, in my position as a contractor. So I did it in Bash. Other than that, I've been playing with vSphere, VMware. What is vSphere? It's a way of talking to a group of VMware machines. Is that right, Al? You've had more to do with it than I have.
vSphere is just like a name for it. It's just a product. Depending, you're using it. So you get ESXi, which is the hypervisor. A type one hypervisor, and which is bare metal. And then vSphere is vSphere Center is one what you can control multiple hosts, ESXi hosts with. So if you've got cluster operating with like shared storage, or have you got a single host, or
it's a cluster without shared storage. I don't know. It's got two data stores, but there's three machines. So maybe there's a
probably an NFS or something server behind between them.
Yeah, like a SAN or something. So
And also vSphere presents an API which you can talk to. So the Vagrant bit is a bit of code that someone's written to let you use Vagrant to bring up, virtual machines based on code. So
when I was looking at that, that was a commercial add-on you had to buy. You couldn't get that for free at the time. Has that changed now?
There's a commercial add-on. If you want to run Vagrant on your local machine and use VMware, you have to pay for it.
Right.
The Vagrant vSphere plugin, you don't. So the company was under the impression that you had to pay for it, so they were kind of umming and ahhing about it, or someone hadn't got around to doing the purchase order because it's that much. It's like something $80 a seat or something. And I just found this. It's a Vagrant plugin, so just a bit of Ruby code which plugs into Vagrant and lets you talk to vSphere. So no need to spend any money.
Really interesting to me, and I wish I'd have known about that about a year and a half ago, because I'd have used that by now. But never mind.
One bad thing about it was you have to put your vSphere credentials in your Vagrant file, which is never good. But there's I did a thing which just basically lets you use an include a file, so you put your credentials elsewhere. So the Vagrant file is portable, then you can upload it to your version control and so on.
Presumably you could also use environment variables.
I'm not sure how that works with Ruby.
I've definitely used it with anyway, we're waffling off subject. It's very interesting to me. I might talk to you offline about that particularly.
Okay, yeah. What else have I been doing? I've been doing some stuff. So related to this, it's this wrapper script. It's called Saran Wrap, actually. Interesting thing about Chef is that all of their things, all of the little tools and stuff, have kind of culinary related names. So Saran Wrap is American for cling film, basically. I wanted to call it cling film, but... wiser heads prevailed, so we say so. The process of writing a template, I used a few more of Ansible's features than I have before. So I won't go into it right now, but there's things I've done with ini files and loops and things that I thought were fairly innovative. But maybe we'll go into that later. And there was also a little known file which I discovered in Ubuntu/Debian at least, which is /lib /init /fstab, which is a file which mounts all of the file systems when a Debian box, Debian or Ubuntu box comes up. So if you are a Linux user and you do a df, you'll see some file systems that have none next to them. And this is the file that defines those. So if you're in doubt, that's what does it.
So that's part of the systemd init system.
Is it?
Yeah. So anything that's init is involved in the... it's either part of the systemd or it might be part of upstart. And I've kind of come across this. So what you can do with the etc. fs tab file is you can mark stuff as being a network device. So you can mark... for example, if you've got... if you use SSHFS or if you use VBoxSF, or any of those sorts of things, you can mark them as being network file systems. And then systemd and upstart before it as well would wait for the network to come up before it would actually start trying to mount those volumes. Mm-hmm. So that's quite a useful part of that. But yeah, like you said, it's basically what does all the disk mounting. So yeah. It's quite cool, actually.
Yeah, it's for things like... there's slash var slash run or something, or slash run, and that was a tempfs file system, but it wasn't in etcfs tab. So I think I just might have done a grep minus capital R to find out where it might be on the, where it might be defined on the file system, and it ended up there. So because we had a what the actual issue was Samba was falling over in some way. And in the logs, it was saying no space left on device. So I reasoned that it was one of the mounted file systems running out of space. And apparently one of the mounted file systems was only something like 50 megs or something like that. And this was being filled up. It was a locking.tdb to do Samba file locking. And whatever process was causing it to fill up was generating thousands of files. So it was a case of just remounting that. So it was bigger. That fixed it.
Very interesting. I've just had a look at that. And that's yes, I'd not come across that file before. And again, it's one of those things where until you've got an issue with it, you don't know these things are in there.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
Very cool. Thank you very much for that.
All right, so that's why we do this podcast. Yeah. what have you been up to, John?
One of my colleagues has recently changed roles, and internally at work we use Skype for Business because we're very much a Microsoft house. The project that he's working on is trying to encourage external developers to talk to this particular team. And my colleague was approached by his boss and was asked, you know, how do we stand up an IRC, you know, a channel on IRC server? And knowing that I was a famous IRC addict from back in my youth, he approached me to sort of ask, you know, how does one get started with that? So I gave him sort of some standard advice about getting on Freenode and registering channels and all those sorts of fun things. And then I said, and of course, the other interesting thing is that matrix.org has got a bridging system. And so the guy that I was talking to uses, well, we've used matrix.org a little bit in the past. And if you don't know what matrix.org is, it's a decentralized chat system. Anyone that was fortunate enough to come to OggCamp will have seen, might have been able to see a talk by the lead developer of Matrix, a guy called Matthew. He was explaining kind of how you can bridge between various different chat systems. And I know that the guys that are doing the development work on this system at work, which I'm not really going into because I don't want to jinx what he's doing, and I don't want him to sort of say to his boss, "Oh, I've had this great idea," and him to say, "Yes, I know, I heard about it on a podcast." Yeah, I've had it on a podcast. But yeah, so I said to him, you know, why not? Because I know that some of them use Slack, which is people that do development work tend to fall into one of about four or five different camps, and it tends to be you do IRC, you do Slack, or you do kind of self-hosted Rocket Chat or Gitter.im and stuff like that. But so I know that Matrix bridges definitely between IRC, Slack, and you can bridge to Rocket Chat and Gitter.im. So I said to him, you know, why not set up an IRC channel on Freenode, for sake of argument, and then bridge to the Slack channel that your internal developers are using, and also, you know, you can then use matrix.org to bridge in your Slack channel, and also you can set up integrations with GitHub, so anytime somebody raises a bug or a pull request or something like that, it can just appear in the channel as a, do you want to react to this and do something with it? All your RSS feeds and things like that. So that's one thing that I was involved in.
Can you also do things like, because there's a lot of what we call chat ops with where you're actually sending commands to your infrastructure, or, you know, getting messages back from something like Jenkins to say your job's failed, or
yes, that sort of those thing. Sorts of things are definitely available. I've not looked into how those sorts of things work, but I know that you can do those sorts of things. Aside from anything else, and the interesting thing for me about matrix.org is that it's native protocol that all the server-to-server and client-to-server communications go over is HTTP, and it's JSON-encoded HTTP. So the way of posting a message to a channel is just an HTTP request.
HTTP post requests. Yeah. Well.
Yeah. So it's dead simple. And the way that Matrix works is it's almost like Git. So it uses the Git tree model to merge. So if I'm running a server and you're running a server, I post to the channel, it uses like a Git commit message to pass it around to all the other nodes, and a Git pull from those other nodes to see where the network is in terms of status. Very, quite a cool kind of method, which means that if my server goes offline for 5 days, it doesn't matter because we get eventual consistency. When my server comes back up, it just asks all the other servers that it talks to, can I have an updated status? And they will all backfill your history. So that's quite cool. I like Matrix.
Yeah, sounds cool.
The only downside that I've found with Matrix so far is that it is very much it comes across a lot like IRC. So if you're not comfortable with IRC as a communication mechanism, it can be a bit odd. Matrix can do voice chat and it can do video chat as well. It can be a WebRTC server. So one of the integrations you can add in is a free video conferencing service called Jitsi. So that's quite cool.
And was there someone from Matrix at OddCamp?
Yeah, so the lead developer for Matrix, Matthew Hodgson, was at OddCamp on day two, talking about matrix.org and trying to get people to back the Patreon and stuff that they're running at the moment, which is all quite cool. And all quite interesting.
But I think one of the main things with Slack and, you know, something like Telegram and so on is the kind of the richness of the chat. You know, you can insert links, pictures, you know, GIFs. A lot of people have Slack GIFs. it's something nicer to look at than just text going and. You know, things like threading and replies and that sort of thing, which you can't do in IRC.
Yeah, so threading and replies is definitely something that's missing. But and from, I'm definitely missed the sticker packs in Matrix that you get in Telegram. But that said, the good thing about Matrix is it's all free software. It's not free software. It's open source. I think it's licensed under an MIT license. So there's no, you can run your own server and you can make changes and sort of request them back into upstream. Mm. So, I was going to go into the other thing that I've been doing, which is I'm trying to set up an Ansible environment for lug.org.uk, which is another project that I'm involved in. But that's we're running a bit long on sort of the introduction so far. So.
But we were talking about Git. What's this thing about Git then? We were talking about pull requests and other things, which we all get onto.
So the reason that I'm back with you guys again, is because I'm quite passionate about a thing that's going on at the moment called Hacktoberfest, which is a project between a little-known website called GitHub and a little-known hosting provider called DigitalOcean. And between the pair of them, the guys from DigitalOcean have basically said that if you make four pull requests, and I'll explain what that is in a minute, if you make four pull requests against open source projects on GitHub between the 1st and the 31st of October, you get a free T-shirt and some stickers from the Hacktoberfest initiative, which is at hacktoberfest.digitalocean.com. And essentially, this is trying to encourage people to learn more about Git, to learn more about open source, and to figure out kind of how to be involved in the open source ecosystem that that revolves around GitHub as a central point of focus. But realistically, the skills that you learn through doing sort of Hacktoberfest can be transferred to any of the Git-based web UI environments. So, Git.
Where do you start?
Well, let's start at GitHub and work downhill from there. So GitHub is a web front-end and hosting provider for Git. And essentially, it takes what some people see as being quite a scary feeling concept of working with Git and wraps it into some very friendly and user-focused tools. So making changes to files in Git is dead simple. Making changes and asking people to accept your changes into their code, very, very straightforward process. Filing bugs, creating documentation with wikis, all of these things are possible. If you're used to working in an agile development environment, there are Kanban boards and sort of projects and things like this. So these are all things that you can do that make life a little bit easier for interacting with Git. So Git is, if anyone is used to the sort of grandfather, father, son methodology of doing backups, Git's a bit of a step ahead of that. At its simplest level, if I, as a single developer, am working on a project, and in fact, actually, I am working on a few projects, and it's only me working on it, you might think to yourself, there's no point in me using Git for the code that I'm working on. And in fact, I've had conversations with people talking about, you know, using version control systems, where they've said, well, it's just, you know, it's me and my colleague, and it's just the pair of us, and we both know where we're up to at all times with Git, without code. So we just push to master, or not, they wouldn't use the term pushing to master because that's a Git terminology. But, you know, we're just using the same web server, and we're just pushing the code over each other's got there, which is fine. You know, if that's the way you work, that's the way you work. But what happens with is that what happens is you build up a history of all the changes that have happened to your system. So from the very beginnings of your working with Git, you would do a git init, which basically initializes your directory and says, this is a git operating environment. You add a file. So you create a file. So, you know, the standard example of this is, you know, echo hello world output to readme.txt. So you've now got a file in your version control system. You run the command git status, and that says you've got one file that's not being tracked. So you then do git add that file name, readme.txt. And that then when you do git status again, it says you've got this file that's in your history, in your version control system, but that you've not yet committed. You do git commit, and it brings up a text editor, and you say, you know, first commit exclamation mark or whatever. And then that's now in your local history. And you can keep git add, so making changes, git add, git commit, make change, git add, git commit, and so on and so forth.
So when you make a change to that file, git, and you do a git status, it will automatically detect that that file has changed.
Correct.
Yeah.
The point at which this starts becoming more interesting, particularly for me, is when you then do a git push. And so I'm, as I said, I'm working on a project for lug.org.uk, and my intention is to make it so that we have a Vagrant initiated Ansible powered virtualization of the lug.org.uk project. So it's just me that's working on it at the moment. But every commit that I'm making to it gets pushed into this central repository. So it now means that if next week I hand this project over to the other lug.org.uk admins and say to them, you know, this is what I want to do, this is how I think it should work, they can then look through the change, the code that I've written, and see how I've decided to make each of my changes and why I've decided to work on it in that particular method, so that they can see kind of what my thought processes were around, you know, why are you standing up the bind DNS service in this file, but you're not configuring it until this file, and those sorts of things. You can see that in my history.
I think the listeners can actually go and see this because it's on GitHub.
That's correct. Yeah. So I've created three separate projects, and I've used a Git feature, a feature that Git has got called a submodule. And essentially, that's just because that's the way that I'm working on stuff at work. I've created a common role. So if anyone that's worked with Ansible knows about roles, I've created a role for all of the lug.org.uk servers, and that's called common. So that's one repository. And then the overarching Ansible playbooks and variables and all the stuff that makes the Ansible stuff work, that's in the Ansible playbook. And then the Vagrant file has the Ansible playbook as a submodule itself. So basically, I've got this chain of three sets of repositories. So if I'm handing this just to an admin that doesn't care about Vagrant or running a virtual environment or anything like that, they can just run the Ansible stuff. They don't need to get the Vagrant file. If I want to make the role publicly accessible for people to see, you know, how you can have a common role to apply to your servers, then they can just pull that one. But anyway, I'm getting off the subject of GitHub at this point. So, like I said, I've got these three projects there. And if I was stuck on something and I said to Jerry, you understand this feature in Ansible more than I do, can you take a look at this and see what I'm doing wrong? And he takes a look at it and says, actually, I've spotted this whole block of code here and it's not working the way that I think it should be done. He's got two choices. He can either just tell me, you know, raise an issue on the bug tracker and say, this is what I would do to fix it. Or he can fork my repository. And he can either do that by on the GitHub web interface, there's a button in the top corner that says fork. He presses that and asks him where he wants to fork it, into his user account or into another organization. I won't discuss organizations because that just makes things really complicated. So he forks it into his user profile. He then makes his changes either in the web UI or from his local machine, and he then commits and pushes that back into his repository. At that point, you can then make a pull request, which is basically saying, I've made changes to my fork of that tree. Will you accept it into your tree? And that's raised like an issue, like a bug in the system. And I, as the project admin, then get to see in that bug, in that pull request, what the changes are that you've made, all of the commits that you've made to get to that point. And I've got four options. The main two, though, are that I can accept the pull request as is, or I can reject it. So that seems like quite a binary statement. But there is one extra feature they don't really publicize in the GitHub website, which is that I can actually cherry pick individual lines from that. So if I like what Jerry's done for half of it, he's injected a load of comments that I think aren't at all relevant or aren't useful, or I think that the way that he's approached something isn't right, I can then cherry pick individual lines from that and just commit those back in. That means dropping to a command line. You can't just work on it natively like that. But what I could do instead is push those changes back to the pull request and say, actually, I'm not comfortable with the way that you've done this part, and I don't really like the way you've done that part. Can you fix those? So you can then take those, or somebody else can take those change notices to that code and make those changes and commit them to your, make a pull request against your fork of that tree to then pull that into sync with what I wanted. I'll then see, if you then accept those changes into your code, I'll then see that in my pull request that you've accepted them. So I then get a full listing of all the different changes that have happened. I can then look through it and go, yep, happy with that, accept. So the reason why pull requests are such an important thing, particularly during Hacktoberfest, is that it only takes 4 pull requests to get your free T-shirt and stickers from DigitalOcean.
And should probably say at this point, it confused me for quite a while until I actually started using pull requests in my last job. I didn't quite understand what they are, purely because of the name. Pull request doesn't seem like that's what it should be called. It's more like a merge request, because you're looking to merge this code back into the original project or code base.
Yeah, and if you use tools like GitLab or GOGS, I think actually they in fact refer to it as a merge request.
Yeah, well, GitLab has merge requests, but you can do that with branches. So we should probably explain the feature of Git, or feature of any version control system, is that you can branch the code. And so the changes that you make and the commits that you make are different from, or can be different from, the changes you make to the same bit of code. So it's like forking, you know, like a fork in a road. So you have a different history on one branch to what you have on the other branch. And then at a later date, you can merge the branches back together. That's not quite what you were saying about forking. Is slightly different with Git, forking is a GitHub thing rather than a Git thing.
Yes.
Yeah. In GitLab, merge requests apply to branches, as far as I know.
Right.
You might be able to fork projects in GitLab as well, but I'm not sure.
No, and to be fair, a lot of people get GitHub and Git confused, and they assume that GitHub is the way that you do Git, and some people assume that the complexities of Git are what you will encounter when you use GitHub. And in fact, the two statements are completely different. The two statements are completely false. Git as used by major projects. So Git was originally created by Linus Torvalds, who most people that work in IT should know is the guy that founded Linux.
He gave a talk to Google in 2007 about it, I think. It's worth looking up because when I was first learning about Git, which was not that long ago, I watched that and it gives you a good understanding of it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Git was created to fill a particular need that Linus had at the time, which is that the development of the Linux kernel is all done through mailing lists. And whilst there are clones of the Linux kernel with lots of different web front ends to Git, all of the development to the Git tree, to the kernel tree, is done in mailing lists. So all of the patches are submitted between the people as patches. They're not done through pull requests. They're not done through anything like that. Effectively, what the GitHub people did was introduce a sane workflow around Git that wasn't scaled up to many thousands of people contributing to the code base that is the Linux kernel. And they took what is arguably a very geeky, there's kind of two aspects to Git. You've got what they call the plumbing, which is kind of the low level code that makes Git work, and the porcelain, which is the command lines and stuff like that. And almost what the GitHub people did was sort of introduce, you know, cubicles and sort of, you know, attendance, you know, to kind of extend that toilet metaphor somewhat. You know, so they've kind of introduced, as I said, what is effectively quite a sane workflow, which in fact they call the GitHub flow. And there's going to be a link to that in the show notes, hopefully, explaining how kind of that flow works.
So can I get my head around this? So if you've got Git on your local computer, you can, on a folder, you can obviously make different versions of it. You can commit different versions so that if you make an issue on it, if you make an error or whatever, you can then roll back to different versions.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. And
they're called commits.
Commits. And then if you want to, you can then push them up to GitHub if you want to make it public, or if you want to, or if you want to purchase it, you can do it so it's privately. Is that correct?
It's probably worth mentioning, when you do that, when you make your directory, your code base into a Git, you do Git in it, that is actually a Git repository. And you can... So you can push that repository up to GitHub or to anywhere.
Right.
And it's still a Git repository.
So do you have to have SSH keys or something, if I remember correctly, to get them up? Do you have to like have how does it get up to GitHub? Or
That's how...
Sort of.
Yeah.
So there's actually four separate protocols that I'm aware of. There's a native Git tool. So you can use Git to clone between local file systems. So I can go into, if I've got a Git repository in home John project A, and I want to clone project A into project B, so I can then start working on project B with the full version history from project A, I can do Git clone, /home/john/project A.git, and that gives me the full version history of project A. You can email patches between people. So there's a package you can install called Git Email, and that will literally, when you do your Git email, it will generate the patch set between what is your current head, the head
the head being the bit that you're working at the top of the branch that you're on at the moment, and somebody else's point further back in time. There's you can use SSH to push to a remote Git repository, or you can just use HTTPS or HTTP. So I've used GitHub, and I use when I'm working on a project like I mentioned about the lug.org.uk stuff. I clone the lug.org.uk repository using HTTPS, and I then add another remote repository of my own one, which I call mine, over SSH. So that then means that whenever I make a push to mine, I get a couple of minutes of sanity between, do I want to actually commit this into the lug.org.uk master branch, or do I want to trash it off because I made a mistake or anything like that? But also that means that the pull that I'm making from the lug.org.uk tree is over HTTPS. So that means I can share that with anyone. And in fact, the chain of remotes that I was mentioning before between the Vagrant, Ansible, and Roll that I've got, they are all done on the HTTPS leg. Doesn't require any SSH there. But then any additions to that code, any changes to that code are done over SSH. Because I've got SSH keys set up, it means that the two-factor authentication that I've got, I don't need to somehow try and wangle making that work. I also have Git set up through a thing called Sandstorm, and that is only using HTTPS. So I've got basic authentication credentials for my access to the Sandstorm repositories.
One of the issues with that is with basic auth, you have to type in a password, or you can get it to cache the password. But at some point, you have to type in the password to push or pull.
To do either. Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas with SSH keys, you just use the SSH key that's on your either Mac or Linux box, and probably Windows 10 box as well. And that can be used for pushing and pulling. And if you've got an agent set up, you don't have to enter a password or passphrase, assuming you have a passphrase set up on your SSH key. So it's kind of a lot more, it flows a lot better with SSH keys. Can you push with HTTPS then?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So the HTTPS access to the repositories is the same as doing it over SSH.
Right.
It's just like you said, you've either got to store your basic credentials. If you use two-factor authentication on GitHub, which I would strongly recommend in this age of security breaches left, right, and center, you should have two-factor authentication set up on everything that can do two-factor authentication. So that makes it very complicated to do HTTPS pushes. But if you haven't got two-factor auth switched on, or if you've got... you can set up specific application passwords. You can do HTTPS pushes then. But on the whole, I'd say it's easier, unless you're in a restrictive network environment where you can't do SSH connection attempts. You should always use the SSH keys for your SSH, for your HTTP, for your Git pushes. Sorry.
So what type of application can you use in with GitHub then, or whatever?
So the Git account by default gives you unlimited public repositories and one private repository.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to have more than one private repository, or you wanted to invite people into those private repositories, you'd pay for a GitHub account, and at that point it's you start paying like $9 a month per user per month or something like that, and it can go up in various scales from that.
But again, we're talking about the two-factor
authentication. Yeah.
Yeah. What can you use with like Google or whatever, or does it have to be
So it's standard TOTP authentication, which is the Google Authenticator. So if you use Google Authenticator, or if you use KeePass with the Tray TOTP, or if you use there's a whole handful of TOTP clients, they'll all accept the GitHub tokens.
Okay. So that means I can, if I wanted to, I could make a Git repository of my code for my tic-tac-toe, and then you can push it up to GitHub.
Yes.
Cool.
And if you do it in October, I could do a pull request against it, and it could go towards one of my Hacktoberfest things.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, I think all of the pull requests that I've made in Hacktoberfest have been against projects that I'm heavily involved in. So there's a couple of things to do with work, the lug.org.uk things. They're all classed as pull requests.
Okay, I might have to have a go. We'll see if we get this podcast out before the end of October.
If you want to kind of understand how Git works and kind of have a play, it's absolutely worth create an account on GitHub, create a repository. It tells you the steps to make to work with that repository on your machine. GitHub have got a GitHub desktop application for Windows, Mac and Linux. It runs on Electron, so you can run it and it gives you a code editor, and it will help you make your commits against your repositories. If you're comfortable using command line tools, it's just a package install away. It's dead simple. It's really, really simple. I think there's plugins for most major IDEs. So Atom's definitely got a Git client because Atom was written by GitHub. Visual Studio, Eclipse, NetBeans, Vim, Emacs, they've all got Git plugins. So dead simple to make, get started with making commits. But if you don't think of yourself as a coder, but you still want to get involved in learning to use Git, particularly if you're involved in the Microsoft Office world or things like that, Microsoft have published all of the VBA documentation on a GitHub repository. So what you'll find at the bottom of, so last year when I did Hacktoberfest last year, all of my pull requests that counted towards last year's Hacktoberfest target were actually me correcting VBA documentation on the Microsoft site. Nearly killed me, because I'm not really pro Microsoft at the best of times, but you can do it and it does work.
Cool. I could also put I've actually written some Python script as well to publish the podcast. So it auto fills in the MP3 tags, renames it, and then uploads it to the right place as well. So I might have a go at that at some point, or to see if I can get it up. So yeah. And we'll put some links in the show notes as well. I mean, I think it's one about a command you can run, or like a little tutorial where you can type in basically.
So on the Hacktoberfest website, there's a thing there about running your own Hacktoberfest event. And on there was a load of resources. And one of the resources on there is a thing called Learn the Basics of Git in 15 Minutes. The link to that, hopefully, again, will be in the show notes. And that literally is a almost like a point-and-click adventure. You know, and it's an on-screen thing where you do Git init, Git add, touch files, make changes, Git pushes, Git histories, and it will walk you through the whole process of doing Git basics in 15 minutes.
Thanks for the info. I'll have a go at putting it and see if I can get this code up onto GitHub, and then we can go from there. So the other thing interesting, which John was saying, you put on our Telegram group, is about the Wi-Fi vulnerability been released.
My word. Yes.
I haven't heard much else about it than Well, is it like a? I did hear that something about if it's like when you re-authenticate or something, it's where it's failing, or that could be completely wrong or something.
Sort of. So what you can do. Right, I've not really looked into this too much.
I was waiting to hear what Steve Gibson had to say on Security Now.
So yeah, me too.
Better than me.
Right, I for giggles, I on one of the other podcasts that I listen to, the Late Night Linux podcast, they were discussing some of the terminology that's used in this, and we're all chortling like nobody's business. So anyone that's in the UK will recognize this term as not being a very polite one. But in cryptography, it's really useful. And it's the long form version of it is number used once. And in cryptography terms, that's abbreviated to nonce.
Titter, titter, titter.
Yes, very much so. And effectively, what's happening is the standard implementation of the WPA2 personal authentication and encryption mechanism.
PSK?
It is the PSK. But that can be encouraged to reuse those one-time only numbers. Now, I'm not entirely sure what the sequence of events is that gets you to that point. But it happens. So the downside to that is that a lot of cryptography revolves around me having a private number, you having a private number, us using this one-time number that we both encrypt against to get our shared secret out of it. And unfortunately, if you can get it to replay this one-time used number, you can set up a rogue hotspot, force your client machine to authenticate against your rogue hotspot, and then man in the middle there of the conversations, force your own DNS servers in there, reroute the requests to your own servers. So whilst this crack vulnerability is... In a corporate environment, it's devastating, frankly. Assuming that in your corporate environment, you're using WPA2 personal. I've not seen anything yet about whether WPA2 enterprise, which uses Radius and TLS encryption and all those sorts of fun things.
Like certificates and stuff.
Yeah. Whether those things actually can mitigate this risk. I've not seen anything about that yet. And all of the commentary I've seen so far basically says nothing about WPA2 enterprise. Anywhere that's using WPA2, assuming it's more secure than unencrypted, unauthenticated connections or WPA1, basically we're just being told you need to go back to treating it as an unencrypted wire again. But that means that you are still limited to it only being an issue if you're within range of your Wi-Fi signal. So like, for example, the area where I am at the moment, I can see two other Wi-Fi radios from here. And if I see anyone around here with a, you know, high gain antenna or something like that, it's going to be pretty obvious that they're trying to get on my Wi-Fi. Where it becomes more of an issue is like in an office, in a shopping center, in a block of flats, in a highly dense residential area. These are all places where you're more at risk. So in those cases, realistically, you need to do one or two things. Go back to Ethernet, so Cat5 everywhere, which people don't want to do. Or VPNs, which people don't want to do. So, or the people that do want to do VPNs think that VPNs means buying a commercial service online.
Realistically, you can set up a Raspberry Pi as a Wi-Fi, as a VPN terminator. You can get VPN clients for all major mobile phones. You can get VPN clients for all laptops, and so on and so forth. The issue, though, really, then once you've isolated your domestic devices, your laptops, your mobile phones, you then start getting into an internet of things. So I know already that Debian have released a patch that's rolled downstream to Ubuntu. Windows 10 should be releasing soon. Ubuntu 17.10 are currently on freeze, so there will probably be a security release after the ISO's released, which is a slight problem, but anyway. But Windows 10 is coming out with a fix. Your Android 6 Plus is going to have a fix on, you know, your Samsungs, your Sonys, your Motorolas, your Pixel devices. They're all going to come out with fixes. The problem is your older Android devices, people that don't ever update Android devices, and Internet of Things devices, because none of those are going to get a fix to this. So at that point, you then need to say either these devices should be treated as completely untrustworthy and pull them out from your network, or you somehow encourage them to only have individual data streams. I don't really know how it's going to work, to be honest with you, but it's interesting times.
Okay, we'll just have to see how that kind of carries on, really, and see what we get out of it, really.
One of the things that I've seen that's an interesting workaround for the Internet of Things side of things is actually the people from the Tor project are saying if you were able to run a Tor client on these devices, that can be your secured channel, your secured and authenticated channel back to your base stations, because that gives you your encryption tunnel that all your traffic goes down. So then it doesn't matter if your Wi-Fi connection is unencrypted or fully encrypted. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, you've got a VPN set up for the rest of your devices. It doesn't matter. But there you go. That's one option.
Cool. Okay. I think we're just about nearly up to, I think, an hour or so. One thing I was mentioning is about another podcast I found called the Kernel Panic podcast. I think there was another podcast called this before, someone was saying a number of years ago. But this is a new podcast. They're up to eight episodes. If you remember, a couple of weeks ago, I was talking about a Python tutorial I was following on YouTube. They released a video, which is actually a podcast, and it's basically, it's quite interesting. It's just two tech guys talking just about IT, and mainly about, I think they both work in Linux, but they talk about tech industry jobs, what to say in a job interview, if you should switch careers to be a programmer, how to do an interview, and should you do certification, how to deal with recruiters. It's quite a good little podcast. I really enjoyed it. I've listened to all eight of them. I had a bit of a long car journey this week, so I listened to them all in a couple of car journeys. So yeah, I'll just check that out.
Interesting. Cool. Certainly be adding that to my podcast catcher. There's two things that I wanted to mention about. One is that next week is all day DevOps, which, if you're saying we might not get out before the end of October, might be a bit of a problem. But all day DevOps is a free for anyone to attend conference discussing anything about DevOps. Basically, it's all run online, and basically it's video streams that people make available to watch. And I believe that they are usually released after the event as streams that you can consume, sort of one by one. Unfortunately, I've committed myself to going on holiday, so I'm not going to go, and I'm not going to be able to watch any of those. So I'm going to have to use the streams after the event. But that's quite an interesting thing that I think people should, if you're working IT and you're interested in DevOps and kind of agile working and kind of failing fast and pivoting and all those sorts of fun terms that you may or may not have heard of, All Day DevOps is quite an interesting project to take a look at. And the other thing that I mentioned to the guys before we were recording was the PACT Publications free book of the day, which is, as it sounds, every day PACT Publications sticks one of the books that they've published for free download. You have to have an account with them. So that then means they get to send you emails telling you about all the books they've got releasing and coming out and those sorts of fun things. But you do get to get a free book every day. And there are all sorts of weird and wonderful things on there.
I see today it's Mastering Metasploit, second edition.
So, yes.
Yeah.
But I mean, so I've had all sorts of things. There's DevOps for networks. There's learning about Mean, which is MongoDB, Nginx. I can't remember the rest of it, but Node is the end bit. Windows PowerShell scripting, stuff to do with the language called R, PHP 7, Bootstrap, Raspberry Pi. There's all sorts. It's a really interesting thing, and it's worth just kind of checking on it once a day, because it literally runs 7 days a week. So those are my two things.
I'm just claiming it as we speak. So I don't think it's about anything else to mention. I guess our Patreon page, which is now live, which we've got two people in, I think, haven't we?
Yeah,
which maybe one of the
we invite all our Patreon patrons on the show, actually.
Yeah, interesting.
Or try to, if they don't have technical issues.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks again, John, for coming on.
Really, it's always a pleasure.
Good. Okay. Well, you can find us on the media, social medias and stuff. So, and we'll speak to you soon.
I'll speak to you later.
See you next time.